we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
The attacker, I can confirm, died at the arena. We believe the attacker was carrying an improvised explosive device, which he detonated, causing this atrocity. We would ask people not to speculate on his details or share names. This is a complex and wide-ranging investigation. Our priority is to work with the National Counter-Terrorist Policing Network and UK Intelligence Services to establish more details about the individual who carried out this attack.
The effort expended by the British government and its media cohorts in denying any linkage between UK foreign policy and the recent terrorist atrocity in Manchester has been revelatory. It comes as a withering indictment of a political establishment which for far too long has been slavishly attached to the doctrine of foreign military intervention and regime change in pursuit of its geopolitical objectives. It is a doctrine that has only succeeded in sowing instability, chaos and carnage, out of which the monster of Salafi jihadism and Islamist extremism has emerged and grown in our time, to the point where it threatens not only children in Libya, Syria and Iraq, but also now here in the West. In the wake of the Manchester attack, British journalist Peter Oborn wrote a scathing article with the self-explanatory title, Why MI6 Must Share the Blame for the Jihadis in Our Midst. In it, he writes, often with the connivance of MI6, and just in parenthesis, MI6 is the foreign branch of British intelligence, often with the connivance of MI6 during the early years of the Syrian war, Oborn writes, hundreds of British citizens were allowed to travel abroad to join jihadist organisations. The reason MI6 certainly approved such involvement, he continues, was because spy chiefs had taken it upon themselves to meddle in the internal affairs of Middle East countries. In the case of Syria, he writes, they wanted to get as much help as possible in their mission to topple the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad. There was a similar policy towards Libya, he reveals. British citizens, it has been reported that among them was the father of the Manchester suicide bomber, were undoubtedly encouraged to travel to the North African country to fight in the civil war there to get rid of Gaddafi. And later in the same article, Peter Oborn observes that duly, these people were free to join terror groups in the Middle East and North Africa, organisations with links to Al-Qaeda and other terror outfits. Of course, he concludes, as well as being enemies of Al-Assad and Gaddafi, these groups were also enemies of the West. Now, these revelations by Peter Oborn are incredible when you think about it, identifying as he does the sheer folly and idiocy of a foreign policy which could not be more reckless, even if purposely designed to be so. And it really does bear repeating. You cannot go around the world invading, subverting and destroying countries willy-nilly and not expect consequences. Neither is it tenable to depict those who commit acts of barbaric violence in Syria or Libya as rebels, while depicting them as terrorists when they do the same or likewise in France, Belgium or, as in this instance, the UK. At best, this is cognitive dissonance. At worst, contemptible mendacity. Moreover, as the dust settles after this, the latest terrorist attack to erupt in a European city, there needs to be a serious conversation on the relationship between civil liberties and security in the UK and across the West. The idea that individuals such as Salman Abedi, the Manchester suicide bomber who was known to have been on the security radar of the security services, can live under the protection of the law when it comes to upholding said civil liberties and thereby risk violating the most sacred liberty of all, namely the right of children to attend pop concerts and return home alive, as was the case in the Manchester attack, this idea is utterly ludicrous. 22 people were slaughtered in Manchester on the 22nd of May 2017. And as I just said, they were slaughtered while attending a pop concert in the city. Many of the victims were children, the youngest just 8 years of age, while 160 were injured and maimed, many for life. It goes without saying, enough is enough. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, Professor Anthony Glees is a Professor of Politics at the University of Buckingham with specialist knowledge of security and intelligence issues, and he joins me now. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I mentioned in my introduction the scathing article that Peter Oborne wrote, which appeared in the Daily Mail, but you yourself wrote a similarly scathing article in the wake of the Westminster terrorist attack back in April, in which I think seven people were killed, including a police officer outside the British Houses of Parliament. And you identified something that I found, I have to say, astounding, which is the amount of young British Muslims, 1,000 you assert in the article, who have left the UK to travel to the Middle East and become, in your words, murderous foot soldiers of the Islamic State. Anthony, this is chaotic at best. How have we come to this point?
Well, you mentioned Peter Oborne's article, and you know, he's a serious journalist and one should take seriously what he writes. But when he says these ideas are utterly incredulous, he's absolutely right. His ideas are utterly incredulous. The reality of the situation is different and much more complicated. And I think one of the things that has to be done, if one is to come to a proper assessment of where we are in the United Kingdom, in the West, and other countries like Russia affected by jihadism, is that one's got to look at the facts coolly and calmly and not put two and two together to make five. In talking about the origins of Islamism, Oborne's suggestion, which of course is also Jeremy Corbyn's suggestion, that it's a mixture of Western intervention in Arab affairs combined with the meddling of spy chiefs that has generated the jihadist threat we face in the United Kingdom. Well, I think that is just turning the whole thing on its head. It's looking at completely the other way around. 9/11, the Islamists came for the West. We didn't go for them. They came.
Sorry, I just want to interject there, if you don't mind. That point's been made many times when it comes to 9/11. However, the clock does not begin on 9/11. If you go back to Afghanistan in the 1980s, where the Americans and British were supporting Osama bin Laden, in fact, if you look at old newspaper headlines, you'll see pictures of Mr. bin Laden being hailed as a freedom fighter. Also, the 13 years of sanctions on Iraq, which 2 million people were killed, 500,000 of them children, and which, you know, the Americans at that point said that this was a price worth paying. I mean, I think there is a whole bundle of issues that go back longer than before 9/11.
Forgive me interrupting you in return.
Go ahead.
The first Islamist plot in the United Kingdom was hatched in 1999 and uncovered, luckily, in the year 2000. So both before 9/11 and the London bomb plot. And what we're talking about is the attack on the West by people who have a particular ideology. We call it Islamism. It's a perversion of the peaceful faith of Islam in order to justify political violence. If you extrapolate from that, if you pull from that, the attack of 2003 on Saddam Hussein's Iraq and say, oh, that caused Islamism and jihadism, which is what Jeremy Corbyn is saying. As I say, that is the wrong way round. They came for us. And as far as Saddam Hussein is concerned, I don't believe that Saddam Hussein was an Islamist. He chatted to them, we know that.
Well, and he was a committed enemy of Osama bin Laden and Islamism.
Absolutely. He was very anxious about what they were doing. You know, you can play the history game and you go further and further back. But I think the issue, and it's the issue, after all, that should concern us in the aftermath of the appalling attack in Manchester, is the attack by Islamists on the West and on other countries, as I've said, Russia and indeed China. And that does not have to do with foreign policy. It is ideologically driven by fanatics who have a particular interpretation of Islam that they think justifies the use of violence. They want to turn countries into caliphates, into religious states. They don't believe in democracy. They don't believe in people voting. They don't believe in the structures of democracy. And turning to the point about spy chiefs meddling, of course, Peter Oborne doesn't know, and I don't know exactly what our secret intelligence will have tried or hoped to do. But certainly it stands to reason that there will have been interference, as you might put it, in those countries, that Syria, Iraq, and so on, and that giving aid to those people, we believe, rightly or wrongly, that too will have to be tested, and it will be tested, giving aid to those people who said they were both the enemies of Bashar al-Assad, another Saddam Hussein, if ever there was one, and enemies of the so-called Islamic State or Daesh. Well, surely history teaches us that we have to support those people who would be our friends and do what we can to oppose those people who are clearly our enemies. That it may have backfired, I would agree. But the bottom line is here, the people who are responsible for blowing up with bomb in the case of Manchester, stuffed with bolts. Some people were so badly maimed and wounded as they died that it took 2 days to identify who they actually were. The people responsible for that are the Islamists. They're not Britain's spy chiefs or Britain's politicians. You cannot mix up failures of mission with failures of commission.
Anthony, we'll hold it there for a second for a short break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back right after this. Hard Facts. Welcome back to the second half of this episode of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with Professor Anthony Gleese. We are discussing the fallout from the latest terrorist atrocity to erupt in a major European city, this time Manchester in England. 22 people were killed in the attack, the youngest of whom was only 8 years of age, and 160 maimed and injured, many for life. Anthony, I mean, we will have to disagree on the role of foreign policy. For me, the relationship is similar to that between going out in the rain and getting wet. Clearly, these people are responsible. I'm not saying that. I'm not in any way trying to justify what happened, and I want to get on to how we deal with that threat. But it's indisputable, in my view, that the destruction of Iraq, out of which Al-Qaeda in Iraq emerged, which AQI, led by Zarqawi, which morphed into Islamic State of Iraq, which later morphed into ISIS. There is a correlation. Now, Islamism predates all this by a number of decades. Of course it does. But it has escalated and grown exponentially in the last decade and more. And I don't think that's an accident. But clearly you have strong views on that and on that dynamic. And perhaps, as I say, we will have to agree to disagree. But on the issue of Salman Abedi, we do know that he was on the security radar, the 22-year-old British-born Libyan responsible for this terrorist outrage, and that he left the country, went to Libya, where his father had gone to take part. His father lived in the UK, I think, for a number of years. And he'd gone to Libya to take part in the so-called revolution against the Gaddafi government. In my eyes, this was not a revolution, this was an uprising. And I do think it's a mistake to depict those involved in that uprising as Jeffersonian Democrats. They were not. There were some people there involved who definitely did aspire to a democracy. But Islamists were also in the vanguard. Benghazi, we know, was a centre of Islamist opposition to Gaddafi. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group was based there. It dates back to the King Idris monarchy that was toppled by Gaddafi in the late 1960s, part of the so-called Senussi Brotherhood. Now, Abadi was allowed, as I say, to leave the country, came back through Syria, and he carried out his attack. He was on the security radar. This is clearly a problem. Now, just before I get onto that, though, in parenthesis, I do applaud the work of the security services in this country and throughout Europe. They are doing tireless work in very difficult circumstances to get on top of this, and nobody knows how many attacks are thwarted as a result of their efforts. But there's something wrong when these people are allowed to come onto the security radar and allowed to slip off it to carry out these attacks. And we're going to get into the issue of civil liberties and security, which I also touched upon in my introduction. What do you think are the particular failings? Is it lack of resources? Is it an operational issue? Or is it the constraints posed by existing legislation when it comes to civil liberties? Or perhaps it's even a mix of all three?
I think it probably is a mix of all three. It's always safe to talk about mixes because nobody can bite your head off if you happen to pick on the wrong one. Yes, as you said there, we're going to have to agree to disagree on foreign policy. In my view, the Islamists would come for us, whatever our foreign policy had been. And if states do not show that they are strong and prepared to fight, if necessary, for their fundamental values, then they appear vulnerable and like being in a jungle, a beast of prey will prey on the wounded animal. And we have to be strong. There's no doubt about that. And a terrorist outrage demands intervention. It demands a strong response. In the case of France, people will remember the Bataclan attack in 2015. Within 3 days, President Hollande had ordered the Force de Frappe to fly against IS targets in Raqqa. Nothing like that has happened in the United Kingdom, and it's partly because I think public opinion in a way reflects your own view that intervention is not something that good. People may remember that in 2013, David Cameron tried to intervene in Syria to cool the situation and indeed to try and get weapons of mass destruction off Bashar al-Assad. His own party, the Conservative Party, for goodness sake, refused to give him permission to do that.
Sorry, that would have been illegal in international law, that intervention. And it is actually British forces, Air Force, American forces, all foreign forces involved in the Syrian conflict right now, out with the expressed permission of the Syrian government, they're violating international law.
Using chemical weapons to poison your own people is also against international law. But Leslie, as you say, we've got to agree to disagree. Let's turn to MI5 and the failures, the intelligence failures and the security failures that undoubtedly enabled the attack by Abedi in Manchester to take place. Don't let's forget, he was responsible for them. He was to blame, and the Islamists who trained and supported him were to be blamed. But our security community is charged with keeping us safe. And although, you know, probably a dozen Islamist plots have been successfully thwarted, the Manchester bomber got through just as the Westminster butcher got through several weeks ago when he carried out his attack on the Palace of Westminster and mowed people down. So there are failings, and these failings are serious and need to be looked at. I think the very first thing to say is that our security service is far too small. You mentioned an article I wrote for the Daily Mail where I said I thought the official figure of 3,000 jihadists in the United Kingdom was far too low. And I said I thought it was more like 10,000. A lot of people got very cross with me and said, well, it's far too high. This is a securocrat. He's asking for an expansion in MI5 and justifying it with fictitious numbers. Well, on Friday last, our security minister, Ben Wallace, confirmed that the number of potential jihadists in the United Kingdom wasn't 3,000, wasn't 10,000 as I thought, but was 23,000, 23,000. And a security service of, you know, say 3,000, 3,500 officers.
Yeah, sorry, I'm looking at the article now, 3,800. I was surprised by that, that it's actually so small, especially in the current climate. I mean, that is astoundingly small as far as I'm concerned.
It is, and one reason that it is so small is that, dare I describe them as the hand-wringing liberals, the chattering classes, don't want to have a security service. Don't want a secret service that is too big. And we've heard civil liberties groups talk about Stasi. Even Donald Trump talked about the offensive nature of intelligence services in the United States of America. People get very worried. But if you've got 28,000 people who could do you serious damage, then a small security service is not going to be able to cope. And I think that was the problem. What MI5 have to decide every time they get a lead is the person they're looking at an essential target on whom they must focus their resources, or is that person a desirable target but not of immediate urgency? Too often, because they're not enough of them, MI5 officers have made the wrong call. And clearly in the case of Abedi, they made the wrong call. But they weren't the only people to get this seriously wrong. And if we begin to look at who these people might be, we'll get a clearer picture. For one thing, in the United Kingdom, we have measures, temporary exclusion orders, or terrorism investigation and prevention measures, so-called TPIMs, even enhanced TPIMs, which allow the authorities to exclude or keep an eye on people who might be doing us or might wish to do us serious harm. Anybody coming to the United Kingdom, age 22, 23, 24, in their 20s, or over the age of 18, who'd been to a place like Libya, who's been to a place where there is dangerous terrorism endemic, those people should not be allowed into the United Kingdom without let or hindrance, as Abedi was. Peter Oborne says, oh, that's because somehow MI5 or MI6 were involved in this. I don't believe that for one second. I don't think anybody had the first idea when Abed came back to the United Kingdom that he hadn't been on a day trip or whatever to Dusseldorf, but had actually come from Libya where he'd had training.
We also have to introduce into this topic the role of the Muslim community in Manchester and elsewhere who tried to warn, we know now, the security services about Mr. Abedi, and for whatever reason those warnings were parked, they were not acted upon. And so clearly the Muslim community here deserves huge praise for trying to interdict. They saw what was going on. They did what many people have criticised them for not doing, especially on the right of the political spectrum in the UK. They stepped forward and they tried to warn the security services of Mr. Abedi's increasing radicalisation and the fact that he posed a threat. And I think you've been a little bit unfair when it comes to Peter Oborne, Anthony, and you're entitled to be so, of course. But, I mean, there was no ISIS in Libya until we took part in the NATO air campaign to topple Gaddafi. Gaddafi, by the way, like Saddam Hussein, was a committed enemy of Islamism. And in fact, I think it was at his behest that Osama bin Laden was originally placed on the terrorism watch list in the United States in 1996.
Forgive me, you can't have it both ways. You just said there was no such thing as...
No, I said ISIS. I specifically said ISIS, Daesh.
You know, we can fiddle around with terms.
Yeah.
This is the same thing. We're talking about Al-Qaeda or Daesh or however you like to describe it. We're talking about a phenomenon, as you yourself accepted, that goes back 40 or 50 years. So this isn't new.
How long has our presence in the Middle East been, Anthony? It's been there since the First World War, after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. You would agree, yeah? So I think there is a correlation between Western foreign policy and...
Are you going to go back to the Crusades?
No. Sorry, with respect, that's a little bit facile. But you take my drift. We have to recognise that there's been...
No, I think it's really important to... You know, honest men and women may disagree, but I put it to you that the phenomenon of Islamism, which largely was largely grown in Pakistan, in my view... predates all the stuff that we did and indeed got wrong. And it could well be. I think the argument is totally sustainable, and it's one put by Sir John Chilcot in his excellent report, that whether you were for toppling Saddam Hussein, as I was, or against toppling him, as Jeremy Corbyn and many more important people than I were, we can agree that going in there, destroying Saddam Hussein's regime and then effectively pulling out without doing anything to restore some kind of stability to the country was a grave mistake. If Tony Blair is to be criticized, George W. Bush to be criticized, in my view, it's not because they got rid of an odious dictator.
Oh my word, Anthony, a million people were killed. The entire country was destroyed societal collapse ensued. Anthony, what right do we have to go into any country and decide on what the government should be? I think that's a fundamental question.
Well, it's not deciding what the government should be. In the case of human rights, you can agree with the policy, as I do, or you can disagree with the policy. But the policy of intervention saved lives. Tony Blair went into the former Yugoslavia to save Muslim lives, and rightly so. Just think of the massacre at Srebrenica. So, of course, we should intervene where it's necessary, in my view. And I accept that people may have a different view. But the intervention, it is not the intervention that causes it. In my view, it is the lack of intervention. And that is what Tony Blair is to be blamed for. So there are failings all down the line. And if I may just add a final failing, you're absolutely right when you say the Muslim community, the vast majority of Muslims, whether in Britain or anywhere in the world, want nothing to do with Islamism. They are indeed its chief victims.
Absolutely chief victims. And they're also the people who are doing most to fight it. I'm talking about the Syrian Arab Army, Hezbollah, the Iranians. Why are we not allied with them, Anthony, if we're really serious about tackling this menace? And also, what about our relationship with the Saudis? Surely that is untenable now, given that the wellspring and the fountainhead of this poisonous ideology resides in Riyadh.
Well, we're going to have to totally disagree about that. The Gulf leaders are and have been our allies. But I'd just like to come back to the point you made before about members of the Muslim community going to the security community in the United Kingdom saying, look, we're worried about this chap and nothing happening. It is a sign that the policy pursued by successive British governments known as PREVENT does actually work, because PREVENT places a duty on people to inform the authorities if they suspect that somebody is being drawn into terrorism. And one of the frightening things about the United Kingdom at the moment is that Muslim communities, some of them, they're kind of told they don't like PREVENT, and a lot of Labour politicians and Labour Muslim politicians complain about it. It does actually work. Where it's not working, it seems, is where it applies particularly to higher education. Abedi was a student at the University of Salford. At some point, he dropped out of there. The university doesn't appear to know when that was. But Salford University, like many other British universities, has in the past bitterly complained about the PREVENT duty, which says to professors like me, look, if you're teaching students, you owe a duty of care to them. If you suspect that they're being drawn into extremism, do something about it. And that's where the civil liberties people, the non-interventionists, the opponents of PREVENT come in. They say, oh, it's taking away people's fundamental liberties. You're turning academics and school teachers into spies. No. If you can prevent somebody from becoming an abedi in the first place, that is very much better than trying, in this case, literally, to pick up the pieces after they have attacked.
Anthony, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you for coming on the show. You've been listening to Professor Anthony Glees. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.